If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We just thought we'd like to let you know that you're listening to a multi-award-winning podcast. At the end of June, we picked up the PPA Podcast of the Year Award 2020. And earlier this year, we won Best Specialist Podcast in the Publisher Podcast Awards. So thanks for your support. And we hope that you'll continue listening to History Extra. We have big plans for new podcasts ahead. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Millie Cawthorne. Today, we're talking about the Picts, the culture that flourished in what's now Scotland in the first millennium AD. Professor Gordon Noble and Dr. Nick Evans, both of Aberdeen University, are experts on the topic. And our content director, David Musgrove, called them to find out more.
Today we're talking about the Picts, and I am joined by two experts on the subject. We've got Professor Gordon Noble and Dr. Nicholas Evans, who are both researchers at the University of Aberdeen. Gordon's an archaeologist and Nick is a historian. So we're going to get two interesting perspectives on the topic. And they've written a book, The King in the North, The Pictish Realm of Fortrio and Kay. And they're also involved with a couple of research projects, one called The Northern Picts and one called Comparative Kingship, the Early Medieval Kingdoms of Northern Britain and Ireland. So, got two chaps here who know a lot about the topic. Listeners may not be aware of what the Picts are at all, so we will be getting into that and explaining exactly what's what. But first up, perhaps we should just talk about the research you've been doing and the current state of play in Pictish study. So can you tell us a little bit about these projects you've been doing and whether they are born out of a resurgence in interest in this topic at the moment? Nick, do you want to kick off with that?
Well, I think there's always been a fascination with the Picts, as they regarded as a lost people who disappeared. And I think that's always going to be tantalizing. And there's always been interest in the symbol stones and in Pictish language and as ancestors of people in Scotland today. But I think really things have sort of taken on a sort of resurgence of interest in the subject. And from a historical side, that started in, I suppose, as early as the 1980s. There were very few people interested, well, who were working on that subject at that point, only a few researchers at universities and outside. And people started at that time, Alfred Smith and also on the archaeological side, Leslie Alcott, to really challenge the view of the Picts as being quite a sort of backward, isolated and strange people on the margins of Europe. And so since then, things have sort of gradually snowballed, I suppose, as more research has been done on the written sources. And then as the archaeology is really where things have changed, I think, dramatically too. And I think people are looking at it in different ways, looking at place names, studies, looking at landscape, and just really being critical about the sources. And I think that's got people really interested. But as I say, I think it's the archaeology that Gordon and others have been doing that has really been the real changing thing that's really changed things as well.
Okay, so a big interdisciplinary sort of approach. Gordon, what's been happening in archaeology?
Well, I think as Nick says, there's been a real resurgence in research, partly prompted by some of the historical views of the subject. For example, Alex Wolff's moving of the Kingdom of Fortru further north, which we'll come on to later. And that was part of the inspiration for our Northern Picts project and now the Comparative Kingship project at the University of Aberdeen. And basically what those projects are about is really trying to identify archaeological sites from this time period, which doesn't sound difficult, but actually we know probably more from an archaeological perspective about the Neolithic than we do about the Pictish period in Scotland. You know, there's very few sites actually known, a handful of settlements really in lowland Scotland, for example. So really our project has been about using an archaeological lens to look at things like the famous Pictish symbol stones, and using archaeological techniques to uncover more sites and more knowledge about this time period. So we've been looking at Pictish forts, Pictish settlements, looking at metalwork hoards, rediscovering part of the Goldcross hoard with the National Museum, for example, working on major Pictish power centres, places like Rhynie and Burghead. So really been trying to just use our resources in a way that really hadn't been done before in terms of trying to provide a new perspective on the Picts and find new sites from this time period. You know, it has been successful, I think, to a large degree in finding new Pictish sites and understanding more about Pictish culture. So there's been lots of research-led excavations. And what our projects are also trying to do is really increase public understanding of this topic. So we have things like social media pages and working with local groups like the Rhynie Women to run lots of community events around the Pictish period and the excavations we've been doing.
Okay, brilliant. So I'm just going to try and describe what I understand of what the term Picts mean, and then you can tell me what I've got wrong, and we can try and move on from there. So what I take from it is that Picts is a term that's used to describe the people in northern and eastern Scotland from the sort of the end of the 3rd century AD for another half a millennium or so up towards the 10th century or thereabouts. And I suppose the question of whether this is a historical term to describe a period or a description of a specific ethnic grouping or a kingdom or kingdoms is kind of what we will hopefully explore a bit. But what have I got wrong so far in that opening description?
Well, I think this is definitely one for Nick.
I actually don't think you got much at all wrong in that. I think that seemed quite correct.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of anything. But I would say that although it's useful as a term for a time period, there were definitely people being called Picts or Picti in Latin, as it is found in the sources. So in that sense, it's a term that is ethnic and has connotations. So that gives it the structure and the geographical bounds to the area that we call Pictish as well.
Okay, brilliant. So let's just go back to the start then. Nick, can you talk about the origin of the word Picts? And we've got, as you said, the first reference to Picti, I think, comes in the late 3rd century from classical authors. And I think in your book you say something like it's best interpreted as a new collective term for the generally larger polities that had superseded smaller population groups referenced in earlier Roman sources. So just drop us into where we are in time and space with that.
Well, as you say, the first reference is in the late 3rd century AD, and it appears in a praise poem which is dated to around AD 297 or 298, which is written for Constantius Chlorus, the father of the later emperor Constantine. And it is then used in the later Roman period in 4th and 5th centuries as a term for people attacking the empire. So it seems to be used as a broad term for people living north of the Roman frontier in Britain. Before the the late 3rd century, there are other terms being used. So the Romans wrote about Britons. They also write about the Caledoni as either a single group or a collective group. And in the 2nd century AD, the Greek writer Ptolemy, the geographer, he describes a number of different polities in northern Britain, about 14 in the area that is later in the medieval period Pictish. So what we see is in the middle of the 2nd century AD, at the time when the Romans are at their sort of height in Britain, at the the Antonine War, they have a number of different groups. And then we have around 200 AD, it's already gone down to perhaps about two. Dio Cassius writes about a time when the Romans are again having conflict against the people to the north, that they have been amalgamated into two groups, the Maetae living around the Firth of Forth, around Stirling, and then a group beyond them, the Caledones again, who presumably inhabited the highlands and some of the lowlands to the north. So there's already consolidation, and then about just under 100 years later, we get the Picts appearing as a term. And it does seem as if, although they may not be completely united under a single political entity, we still get references to multiple groups, but they're not so many. So it does seem as if it's a broad collective cultural term for these people who are already there. It's not a new group that's appeared or migrated to the area. It's a pre-existing group. But they seem to be being called that because it means painted. It's a term for the barbaric people to the north who are now much more distinctive compared to the people in the Roman province in what's now England and Wales that are regarded by the Romans as civilized and cultured. And they use this term painted because the people to the north are naked warriors with tattoos all over themselves. And so they've shown that these people are barbaric, and that is where the term originates from. So it's a term that's created by the Romans for people outside, but it's then adopted by the people in the north themselves as a term for that they want to use as a badge of honour, I suppose.
Okay, so it's othering by the Romans. It's pointing out people beyond the Roman boundaries. And you say it was probably a pejorative term of some sort from the Romans to describe people who were uncivilized, outside the boundaries of civilization. But it sounds like it was kind of reclaimed by the Picts themselves. That's roughly where we're at.
Yeah, I think so. Presumably, the Picts, the people to the north, would have had a lot of contact, not just being killed by the Romans, but diplomatic, to some extent trade, gift exchange, as people fighting in the Roman army sometimes, as slaves. And that would have caused sufficient contact for the term to then get transferred and used by the people themselves, as some of them learned Latin and had to deal with Romans and other peoples on the borders too.
And do we imagine from what you're saying that they were actually tattooed and painted, or is that just a sort of a general Roman term for people who aren't civilized, who are barbaric?
It's rather difficult to know that. We certainly in the medieval period don't have any reference to tattooing among the Picts. So, and the Romans and Greeks tended to regard people on the borders as being these sort of savages who the idea of savages often involves people being naked and having weird practices. So it's difficult to know if they're transferring ideas that are generic to the Picts. But certainly the Herodian writing in the 3rd century AD about what's happening around 200 AD among them in the north says that they have designs tattooed on themselves of animals and beasts. So it's not something that comes completely out of the blue, at least in terms of how the Picts people in the north are being described.
Okay, but it's definitely not a whole bunch of people called Picts turning up from somewhere else and suddenly arriving in Scotland. It's just a rebranding of the people who were there. Why? Why would that be the case? Why would the Romans decide that they needed a new name for those people? Was there something else going on? I don't know, maybe this might be something that Gordon has some views on, whether there were sort of archaeological changes that we can recognise at this period.
Well, there's certainly archaeological changes. Unfortunately, that's not always for the better as far as archaeologists are concerned. You know, at the same time, these new historical sources are referring to a new identity, the Picts, is actually the same time period in which we have a real fall off in archaeological evidence. So from round about the 2nd, 3rd century AD, we get an end of the roundhouse tradition. So roundhouses were being built in Scotland and Northern Britain from the Bronze Age or even late Neolithic onwards. And that seems to end sometime in the 2nd or 3rd century, and settlement patterns become much harder to identify. And that's one of the problems of studying the Picts from an archaeological perspective, is that we still only have, you know, a few dozen settlements really from this time period. And we see those changes right across the areas that become part of Pictland. So the Broch settlements in the Northern Isles seem to be abandoned, or the Broch Towers are, and you get these more difficult to understand villages developing round about the Brochs. You get fortified settlements, so things like hill forts and promontory forts re-emerging, and that is one of the site types that we are able to identify, but again in quite small numbers. So during the Roman Iron Age, there's very few hill forts constructed or occupied as far as we can see, but sites like Dunacair, which is one of our Northern Picts sites, shows that some of these were beginning to emerge in that 3rd, 4th century context, and that's really exciting in terms of, you know, they are the type of sites that might be used on the coast for raiding the empire, or at least being in touch with the empire on the doorstep of the Picts. But there's broader changes as well. You get cemeteries re-emerging. So after a very scanty archaeological record from the Iron Age for burial, you get field cemeteries re-emerging again, probably in that 3rd, 4th, certainly by the 5th century AD. So those are things like square barrows and round barrows. Not huge numbers of monuments, so again, it seems to be quite a restricted practice. And you also get the emergence of inscribed stones, most famously amongst the Picts, the symbol stones. And these seem to be some sort of naming tradition associated with elite identities. So you can see that in this time period, in that 3rd, 4th century, and certainly by the 5th, 6th century, you get a whole series of different types of new archaeological sites emerging, but again, in quite low numbers, and that's why projects like ours and Mark Carver's at Port Mahomet, finding sites from this time period is really important in terms of understanding more about the Picts, given the limited historical sources that we do have.
Okay, but am I right in thinking there's nothing, you wouldn't specifically say there's some sort of categorical change in anything, either in historical sources or archaeological sources, that goes with the commencement of the use of the term Picty?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a very noticeable change in the archaeological record in terms of, you know, a difference to what came before. The problem is identifying exactly what is replacing things like the roundhouse tradition. So again, you know, you can literally count in one hand the numbers of settlements we have from the 3rd, 4th centuries in the lowland Scotland. So it does look like they're adopting new forms of architecture, things like rectangular houses, and using forms of architecture that are quite hard to recover archaeologically. So using things like turf walls, cruck frames, that kind of thing. So that makes it difficult to identify these sites later on. You know, they get ploughed out you know, removed by modern agriculture. So that's where things like hill forts and places that haven't been cultivated are quite important in terms of actually revealing the types of, you know, settlement that the Picts were living within.
Okay. And you mentioned the symbol stones just in your previous answer. And if people know much about the Picts, they might be aware of these rather fabulous stones that are associated with the culture. So they start to develop around about this period as well?
Well, that's a huge area of debate. You know, the symbol stones are very iconic amongst the Picts. So there's, you know, over 200 stone monuments across eastern and northern Scotland with these symbols. They are include abstract designs and they include animal designs. And the classic monument tends to be using paired symbols, so two symbols. And these are, as I say, found right across Scotland, and they've been very enigmatic and added to the kind of mystery of the Picts, as you can imagine. So we don't understand what they mean. They seem to be relating to identities of some kind. So in the later stones, you can see that these pair symbols often appear next to individuals. So they're telling you something about their name or their rank or their status. Our best bet is some sort of naming tradition with the symbols meaning, you know, essentially representing a sound and telling us the name of that person. At least that's our best bet for interpreting these things. And then another major aspect of the symbols is, you know, what date did they emerge? And that's been hard to really tackle. You know, how do you date a stone monument? And that's where archaeology comes in. You know, we can't at the moment directly date the carvings or the stone on which they're carved themselves. But what we can do is date the context in which they're found. So again, prior to our work, people wouldn't have really countenanced an early origin for this back in the late Roman period, late Roman Iron Age. But our work at Dunna Cair has maybe suggested that that could well have been the case. So Dunna Cair is today a tiny sea stack just off the coast of Aberdeenshire near Dunnottar Castle, which is a later documented Pictish site. And it's just a tiny sea stack today. But in the 19th century, they found five symbol stones from the site, and they were found by use from the local village, who were told by a local gravedigger that there was gold buried on top of the sea stack. So off they went with their spades in the, you know, early 19th century, climbed on the sea stack at great danger to themselves, started digging, didn't find any gold, which must have been incredibly disappointing. But what they did find was these stones, and they're quite rough and ready symbol stones compared to what we'll see at sites like Rhynie, which we'll talk about later. And they apparently found these in a low stone wall around the edge of the stack, and they threw them into the sea, being used to the day, not knowing at that time really what they were. And it was only in later years that people recovered them. So our project in 2015 went to the site with a professional climber, got on top, and we excavated, and we essentially found what the youth found. We found the low stone wall, which is actually part of a rampart going around the edge of the stack, and buildings inside, very rare buildings of this time period. And the amazing thing about the site is that it's dates. It's actually dates from the 2nd to the late 4th century AD. So exactly in the time period the Picts are first mentioned in those Roman sources. And again, we can't date the stones directly, but the rampart we have dated, and we think that's where the stones came from. And that dates to the 3rd, 4th century. So again, in that late Roman period when the Romans are mentioning the Picts as an identity. So it seems highly likely to us that the stones are emerging, the symbol tradition is emerging in that late Roman period. And it seems most likely that some sort of naming tradition, written tradition, whatever you want to call it, it seems the most likely context for it emerging in terms of being in contact with literate cultures of the Romans and Latin inscriptions and the like. But the Picts, like the Scandinavians with their runes and the Irish with their ogham, are doing their own thing. They're creating their own symbolic system to represent ideas and language and names and identities.
Okay. But Nick, this isn't a... They're not a historical source. There's no. It's not a language specifically that you can read and interpret.
No. It'd be great to be able to connect the symbols to particular individuals and know exactly how they were being what they actually meant. I presume Gordon's right that they even mean whole names or parts of names. I would suspect whole names. And so you could, if you had some sort of Rosetta Stone, get the exact meaning, but we don't have that. So I presume people would have interpreted them in language, but we don't know what the key is to it.
Okay. So up till this point, we've had other people talking about the Picts, the Romans, essentially. Is there any point where we actually get the Picts speaking in their own voices in a language in written text that we can interrogate?
There's only one text that we have that has Pictish origins that is more than just maybe a word or two, and that is the Pictish king lists. They survive in later copies from the period from about 1300 onwards in Ireland and Scotland. And they go back to a Pictish source of the 9th century, which tells us about the kings supposedly going back into the first millennium BC. And so that's the only statement that we have that seems to have origins, and we can reconstruct back to the Pictish period that text and get some idea of what they thought about themselves. They did think of themselves as Picts, and they thought of themselves as the kingdom that was from Fife up to at least Caithness. It's mainly a text in Latin, but has names that are partly Celtic, closest to the language spoken by the British, that's closest to modern Welsh, I suppose. And so we get some idea there of some of their ideas about kingship and also some of the cultural connections. There's a lot of influence from in the 9th century version from the Gaelic-speaking world, which is another Celtic language now spoken in Ireland and in the Isle of Man and also in Western Scotland. So we get that sort of influence already. So but that's all we have. We have a few words and names of people, but most of what we have, even in the medieval period, is written by outsiders, unfortunately. But we get enough to know that to get a reasonable amount from those sources, at least. So they're one of the better documented peoples that are only spoken of by outsiders, fortunately.
So essentially, it's a pretty tough gig being a historian of the Picts.
Yes, you're dealing with a lot of fragments. And we fortunately have the Irish Chronicles, which were partly written in the 6th to early 8th century on Iona, on the west coast of Scotland. And that tells us quite a lot of events that involve the Picts, as well as involving them and their neighbours. But it tends to be quite sparse. And we get very little actually about social customs from these sources. So we are reliant on that side a lot for our evidence from either comparative work or from with looking at Anglo-Saxons, Irish, so on, and also from the archaeology.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So it's definitely exciting to get all this new archaeological evidence and exciting to get all this new dating evidence, but we are very far from catching up with the likes of the archaeological record of the Anglo-Saxons or contemporary Irish society. So I think there's still a long way to go in terms of our archaeological understanding of this time period.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So jogging on a bit into the period. So we've sort of talked about where they came from and where the starting point is. Moving on into the second half of the first millennium. Gordon, you've talked about a rich ideological language of rulership being consolidated at major power centres. So we are getting the growth of of kingdoms, or a kingdom. You'll have to explain which it is. And we're getting you know, some sort of organised structure. I suppose we need to know they're not the only people in Scotland, what we understand of Scotland. So Nick talks about Gaelic there, people. So who's where and what's happening? And you mentioned the sculpture, the man with the axe, and how that may be some sort of linked to paganism. And you use the word pagan. Where does Christianity fit in here? Is there any evidence of Christianity in the archaeological work that you've done on these sites?
Not in the Rhine Valley. There's a church dedicated to St. Luag, who is an early Christian saint. But a lot of those coinings of those dedications may well be quite late in Aberdeenshire, maybe 11th, 12th century. And we've done various survey work around about the church at Rhynie and not found any evidence of any earlier enclosure. And the site is abandoned, certainly the Barflat site seems to be abandoned by the mid-6th century. So may well have been abandoned before people in the area were Christian. They're probably aware of Christians elsewhere. And certainly some of the Picts were Christian by this time period, which is something more that Nick can tell us about.
Yeah, over to you, Nick. Where does Christianity fit into the story? When do the Pictish people start to take on Christianity, and what do we know about it?
Well, I think with this, you're having to deal with sort of layers of later sort of rewriting of history that you get in the medieval period, in which they associate the conversion of people with saints like St. Columba of Iona, and also St. Ninian, who's of Whithorn and supposed to convert the southern Picts. And most of that is later sort of fabrication to explain later church situations. So we have virtually nothing about how people in the Pictish areas were converted. What we do know is that it's definitely taken place by the end of the 7th century. In the early 7th century, we have some evidence for churches, monasteries in a couple of places in Pictland. And my view is partly would be more positive than quite a lot of scholars have been about the date of Christianity. I would be quite willing to suggest that, like in Ireland, there were Christian missionaries active from the 5th century, even before, just taking the Roman practices at the time of trying to expand Christianity. So I think you probably got quite a mixed situation in places like Rhynie. They probably, as Gordon say, knew about Christianity, and there may well have been some Christians there already. But the interaction is one of these things that's really difficult to tell unless we have some direct evidence. And from what I can gather from the archaeological evidence, at that point, you're not likely to get Christian cemeteries, and that much, archaeologically speaking, that would indicate there were Christians. So I'm willing to be more in favour of, from the contextual evidence, that there were some Christians. Certainly, you would have Christianity there by the 7th century. No one, like the Anglo-Saxons, when they're attacking them, suggests that they are anything other than Christian, and they would have tried to denounce pagan customs if they saw them. So I think it's really difficult to tell, but I think there's I think it's a long process, and one which we really haven't got that much idea of the details, but I wouldn't be surprised if we at some point found there was something Christian around in that area. But I think it's something that's an ongoing process. We just don't have a huge amount of evidence for it. That sounds really bad from a historian, I have to say. Yeah.
Shall we move on from dietary habits and social tendencies to back to politics? The book that you've talked about uses the name of the Kingdom of Fortru, which become when does that start to be an entity first up? Who can tell me that?
Well, we get first references to Fortru in as with an F at the start in the late 7th century, but we do also get reference to their predecessor, the sort of ancestor, population group, the Virtuiones, in the Roman period in the late 4th century, in the text by the Res Gestae by Ammianus Marcellinus, is one of the two major Pictish groups. So they seem to be one example of continuity. And so they are a group that was thought to be based around the southern Pictish area, around in the areas that are now of Perthshire, Stirlingshire, Clackmannanshire. But Alex Wolfe, as I think Gordon mentioned earlier, so in 2005 was able to argue, I think justifiably, that actually Fortiu was much further north, around the Murray Firth. And so that's completely transformed our whole idea of Pictish political geography. And so it seems what happens in the late 7th century is that when there are Northumbrians dominating most of Pictland, the Kingdom of Fortiu may be subordinate, but then in the Battle of Nechtensmere in 685 AD, they defeat the Northumbrians, kill the king of the Northumbrians called Egbert, and set up themselves as the kings of the wider Pictish area, and then become the dominant kingdom and over kings of the Picts for the rest of the Pictish period. So it's an important region that becomes the sort of foundation of the wider kingship that we see in the sources, like Bede, Ecclesiastical History, and other texts.
Okay, and just as a reminder, so the Northumbrians, that's the Anglo-Saxon kingdom to the south. Okay, so after Nechtensmere, as you've outlined, Nick, we've got this sort of the Picts are able to stand on their own two feet in their own kingdom, and the Northumbrians aren't able to lay the law on them or whatever they were trying to do. So what are the dynamics going on as we progress through the first millennium? Who's in charge where, and what sort of identities are we finding?
Well, we have the Picts who were in the 8th century pretty much the dominant power north of the Firth of Forth. So you have the Northumbrians still in the south, and you have the Britons around Glasgow, and you have the Gaels in the west. But the kingdom of the Picts is able to expand, and in the 730s, 740s conquers Dalriada as well, and so is pretty powerful there. Its relationships with the Britons and the Anglo-Saxons is not always peaceful, but there's a lot of interchange between all the groups in what is now Scotland, and so there's quite a few cases where we have exchange culturally. So the Pictish king Nechtan in the 710s invites the abbot Chilfrith of Mugwirmouth Jarrow to, for instance, give him some guidance on the Easter date of the Easter each year, and that sort of thing. So there's I think more archaeological evidence for exchange of in art styles and technology and so on. So you get quite a lot of interaction that is peaceful. There's not fixed boundaries between these groups, and there's it's one where there's Picts are powerful before the Vikings come along, but in the sort of interactive way. There's Gaelic settlement going on probably into Pictland quite considerably in the 7th, 8th centuries and 9th centuries. So it's not just a single Pictish versus Gaelic divide. And politically, as the Picts are dominant over the Gaelic area in the west, there seems to be a sort of assimilation of the elites in the west as well.
Where are we? So I suppose what we need to know is what sort of society is developing in the second half of the first millennium. So what do we know about what the Picts are doing and what sort of society they live in?
Well, from an archaeological perspective, when we get that over kingship developing in the 7th century is quite an interesting one archaeologically, again, because that seems to coincide with developments in things like elite settlements and fortified settlements. So one of the classic site types, again, are forts, hill forts, And it seems to be round about to the end of the 6th century into the 7th century that you get development of sites like the so-called nuclear forts, which are basically citadel forts with complex outer enclosures emerging. So quite large defended settlements again. And that seems to be a developed phase of the first millennium, again happening somewhere around about the 7th century. So it seems to broadly coincide with the greater power of the Pictish kingdoms as represented in historical sources and as represented by the emergence of that over kingship. So again, it's interesting to try and look at the archaeological record and the historical record in tandem to see how these are developing through time. And we are finding those synergies in the sources and the archaeological record for the same time period. So it might be, for example, you know, that sites like Rhynie seem to end sometime in the 6th century, maybe going on into the 7th century. And it could be the expansion of the Kingdom of Fortru that really ends sites like Rhynie, these centres further east. So again, it's questions like that and that we can begin to tackle through our growing archaeological evidence and being able to relate that to the historical sources.
Okay, so we'd better sort of move towards the end a bit. At some point, we stop talking about the Picts and they disappear. So When do we stop hearing about the Picts, and let's try and understand why they might not survive? So, Nick, do you want to give us the historical line on that?
The last reference to the Picts that we get is usually in the late 9th century. From 900 AD onwards, we start getting the kingdom being called the Kingdom of Alba, and it becomes Gaelic in culture and language. And Pictish terms like Fortru go as well. So it seems as if what's happening is that there's been a sort of tipping point in which the culture has shifted to a Gaelic one. That seems to be partly because of increasing Gaelic settlement. Also that the elite is becoming Gaelicized through the church as well. And that, I think, causes a shift. At the same time, you have the Vikings attacking and settling in the west and in the north of Scotland in areas that were controlled by the Picts, and also occupying Pictland at the same time as the Vikings are also being involved in England at the time of Alfred the Great. So this seems to probably cause a crisis that arguably is resolved partly through adopting a new identity, this identity of the Kingdom of Alba, and rejecting Pictish identity in favour of something that's more Gaelic and to some extent new, but using a lot of the same foundations that have been there in Pictish times. It's basically the Pictish polity being rebranded and shifting to favouring an element that had been growing in importance, the Gaelic element, and we see Pictish identity and language fading out.
Thanks, Nick. What do you understand, Gordon, of the demise of the Picts? If that's the, it's probably not the right word or anything.
Well, I think, as Nick says, you know, this is a major period of transformation. It's the period in which Viking attacks are causing havoc throughout the Anglo-Saxon areas. And there's a whole series of battles the Picts are involved in terms of fighting the Vikings. Major kings of the Picts and leaders being killed by the Vikings. So I think that's definitely going to be one major factor we have to account for in this time period. And certainly you can see that places like Port Mahomet argued to come to an end due to a major Viking raid sometime in the 9th century. And places like Burgh Head, a secular power centre, the archaeological record seems to come to an abrupt halt sometime in the late 9th century, or probably more likely the early 10th century. And that was a major power centre of the Picts in the Northern Territories. So if you've got sites like that going out out of use, and the people who are in charge of those sites are being killed or having to move elsewhere, that's going to obviously cause major disruptions within the Pictish areas. And really, the way to respond to that is to transform, and that seems to be what's happening in that 9th and 10th century context, where you get some sort of merging of Picts and Gaels to create this kingdom of Alba. And it's probably, as Nick says, it's an elite change, a change at the top. It probably didn't mean a huge amount to the lower levels in society in terms of how things would have changed. And certainly, as Nick says, Gaelic seems to come to the fore in terms of language and customs. And that's a change that's likely to have been going back centuries with the growing influence of the church. So I think it's a really fascinating time period, both historically and archaeologically. And again, it's not a period archaeologically that's had much attention in mainland Scotland as opposed to the Northern Isles. So that's, again, something we'd like to try and change.
Okay, so to wrap up and go back to what I was talking about at the start, which was what Picts actually means, and I was just picking up on an In Our Time episode that you were in, Gordon, actually, presented by Melvin Bragg, and one of the other contributors, Glasgow University's Catherine Forsyth, said something along the lines that basically that Picts is a time period. It's like the Victorian period, so you wouldn't say that, you know, what happened to the Victorians, where did they go? It's just you moved on from that to the next period. Is that right? Is that the way we should see this Pictish period?
You want to go first, Nick?
I think I would regard it as being more than just a time period, because I do think there's good evidence that there's an identity there that's quite strong. I think her idea that there's a lot of continuity from the people who are Picts and not people who just appear there, and the people who they don't just disappear afterwards, I think is right. So in that sense, I agree with a lot of what her thinking is. And I do think we shouldn't go overboard with just saying there's set idea of the Picts that's there from the start and continues for the whole period. I think there's a lot of early evidence for different identities and different local and regional identities too. So I think we have to factor that in and not get completely bogged down in the idea of you know, it's just there's being a set idea of who the Picts are. But I do think it is more than just, I suppose, a time period thing. But I think she's on the right lines, I think, though, in a lot of what her thinking is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's broadly right. But as Nick says, there is more to it as well, in terms of, you know, there was, a defined identity that late Roman sources refer to as being Pictish, and early medieval sources refer to being as Pictish. And also seems to be a language that was distinct from others in Scotland at the time as well. And that might be one of the contributing factors to the end of the Picts as an identity, is the language is shifting and the language of the court becomes Gaelic. So in order to explain that in later time periods, I guess it's an easy get out is to think of the Picts as being destroyed or killed in some big conspiracy. But in terms of, again, how things operated on the ground, it probably would have been relatively little change for most people. And in terms of, you know, where that Pictish identity emerges from, there are lots of fantastical origin myths about the Picts and where they came from. And that's where, again, archaeology might be able to play some role. So our researchers, Linus Flink, and lots of collaborators doing lots of new interesting genetic work, looking at Pictish burials and the genetic inheritance of the individuals buried in these graves. Still early days there, but as far as we can see, you know, the individuals buried in these Pictish monuments were broadly aligned with the genetic evidence you would get from Iron Age and Roman Iron Age in Northern Britain. So again, it's more about political change than genetic or a ethnic change, and it's really piecing together those historical sources and the archaeological evidence that's really, I think, really exciting about Pictish studies at the moment.
Okay, and just to wrap up, then you sort of, I think, Gordon, at the start you talked about the Picts as a lost people, and that being one of the sort of the beautiful enigmas of them. So they, I suppose, they were kind of lost for a while. People maybe didn't take as much interest in the Picts and the culture as they might have done. But now, as you say, people like yourself, Nick, and other researchers are doing a lot to bring them into sharper focus. So what does that mean for the sort of the legacy of this period? Are they now becoming a found people? And where's it going to go from here, do you suppose? What are we going to find out about them?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think they still are a lost people in many respects. Although we are beginning to enrich in that archaeological record, we're still going from a very low base level. So again, you know, in terms of archaeological sites on the ground, we have hundreds, thousands of archaeological sites from the Neolithic or Bronze Age, for example. And, you know, you're again talking about a few dozen in the lowlands of Scotland for the Pictish period. So it's definitely exciting to get all this new archaeological evidence and exciting to get all this new dating evidence. But we're very far from catching up with the likes of the archaeological record of the Anglo-Saxons or contemporary Irish society. So I think there's still a long way to go in terms of our archaeological understanding of this time period. In terms of historical sources, Nick can say more, but again, we're dealing with a relatively slim record compared to many contemporary societies.
Nick, last word for you?
Yeah, I would agree with what Gordon says. I think there's some written evidence, but it's really problematic for especially ordinary life. And I think we are making advances, but it's, and particularly looking at new approaches combining with archaeology. So I think that's where we can make a lot of progress. But I think we're still working from a lower level, but hopefully we'll be able to get enough to really start to say things in the next decades. Yeah. And through primarily the archaeological work. Yeah.
Okay, well, I've certainly found out a lot about this lost people. So, Professor Gordon Noble, Dr. Nicholas Evans, thank you very much for your time and for giving us chapter and verse on the Picts. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
That was Gordon Noble and Nick Evans. To find Dave Mudsgrove's blog covering all things medieval, including the Picts, go to historyextra.com and search for blog. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. In our next podcast tomorrow, Ian McInnes will be answering your questions on the Scottish Wars of Independence.